This morning I'd like to continue a particular series of talks that I've been giving over this year on the Eightfold Path. And some of you have been going through the series, coming, you know, on Sundays or Fridays when I've been doing the day long on the topic. And so I want to talk about the Eightfold Path, and I want to talk about now, we're talking about the seventh factor of the Eightfold Path, which is the factor of right mindfulness, or appropriate mindfulness. And mindfulness is central to what we do in our practice here, so it's perhaps an interesting topic to look at anew. And in looking at right mindfulness, we have to understand that it's part of the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path, the word path is very interesting. Magga in Pali, marga in Sanskrit. The word religion in the West has no obvious, didn't until recent times, until people in Asia invented it, but until recent times, the word religion didn't have an easy Asian parallel. Then, you know, you couldn't translate into Asian easily. And it seems very strange that, you know, such a central concept in the West, so central to what we do here, and you can even get non-profit status from it, that there's no easy word that translates the word religion. But one of the words that's closest to it, or that's, I mean, not, doesn't correspond, which is parallel, is the word path, marga or magga. And Buddhism in India is known as a marga, as a path. And other religions in India were also known as paths. And you get into China and Japan, you have the idea of the Dao, Do. So there's a way of something. So again, it has a way, a path. And this suggestion of a path is it's something that you walk on, something you engage in. So it's a journey. It's something, a developmental journey where you go from one place to another. And in that sense, what you do, the practices you undertake, the journey you take, is more important than what you believe. Sometimes in the Western notion of religion, the idea of a creed is very important. So you have to believe something. Unless you believe the right thing, sometimes terrible things can happen to you. So belief becomes really important. Certainly belief is an element of Buddhist practice, but it's far outshined by the importance of what you do, the practices you do, the path that you walk on. So Buddhism is a path and a journey. And that path, there's a beautiful analogy for that path, which I'll give you. Some of you have heard it before. And this analogy treats you as royalty, treats you as being important, as a king or a queen. So if you take this analogy and apply it, you're in the position of the king or the queen in this story. So it's a very, and who's going to engage on this path, clear this path. So already we have the notion that of a high sense of respect or dignity for the person who's going to walk the path, kind of royalty. And the analogy is that, or the way it's told, imagine a person who goes into the jungle for the first, you know, maybe an explorer, and the jungle is quite overgrown, but there is very faint traces occasionally of a path in, or an ancient road in that jungle. It's mostly overgrown. And this explorer is able to follow this ancient path through the underbrush, and until coming to the center of the jungle, there is an ancient palace which has long been forgotten, overgrown, beautiful capital city. And this explorer discovers something which has been long forgotten. Then this explorer goes back out of the jungle and goes back and sees the king and queen and says, I found this ancient path. And it goes to this ancient palace and beautiful capital. And so the king or queen will go then into the edge of the jungle and are pointed out where the path is. And then they kind of clear the path so that we could find that palace. And then they clear the palace from all its overgrown debris and re-inhabit this wonderful palace. So in the same way the Buddha said, he was like the explorer. there is an ancient path that he did not invent, but that there were traces of. And he was able to follow those traces to this wonderful palace, which was a palace of freedom, of liberation. So a liberated mind, a liberated heart is here. And this analogy is held up as being this beautiful place that you can inhabit that's like a palace, a capital. And so, and then the Buddha discovers this, and then the Buddha comes out of the jungle, in a sense, and comes to all of us and says, hey, king and queen, there is this ancient path that you can follow as well, that you can clear. But you know, you have to clear the path. You have to kind of do the work. And you can find this palace. You can find this palace of freedom, of liberation, that you can make for yourself or find in yourself. In this analogy, the freedom and liberation is not something that's foreign from who you are. It's innate to who you are, in the very least, as a potential. It's a potential that we all can attain if we follow a particular journey, a particular path. And it has to be a particular path. If you want to find the palace in the jungle, you don't go into the desert, because then you don't, you know, you won't find it. You have to be able to find the map and know where you're going to go. And so the map that the Buddha gave, or the path that he found, is called the Eightfold Path. It involves 8 different elements to walking this path. And one of those important elements is mindfulness, right mindfulness. So the right mindfulness of the Eightfold Path has a particular meaning. Before I talk about what right mindfulness means, we should maybe talk first what mindfulness is, as opposed to right mindfulness. And mindfulness has a variety of different meanings. And as the Buddhist tradition has evolved in India and different places, and now even here in the modern West, mindfulness is defined in different ways or has different understandings. So you don't just have in the tradition one understanding of what mindfulness is. But you can go back to the time of the Buddha and try to tease apart what did he mean by this thing called mindfulness. And I think it's fair to say that mindfulness is a form or an aspect of awareness. So awareness is a wonderful capacity of the human being, human mind, related to consciousness, to be aware. Awareness is probably present in almost every waking moment. Some people say maybe there's even some kind of awareness that's present when you're sleeping. Awareness being the simple capacity of somehow registering the perceptions, the brain somehow registers stimulus that comes. And so even in sleep, sometimes the body, you might not be conscious, but there is a registering, there's an awareness that takes in stimulus from the world, and you can somehow, that incorporates that. Awareness, the concept of awareness has bedeviled scholars in terms of trying to get a very good technical, scientific, psychological definition. What is awareness or what is consciousness? Even though we all think we know what it is, you know, being aware. But awareness is a capacity, take in stimulus and have it register in some way. And there's many different aspects of awareness or ways in which awareness can be used. Mindfulness is a particular way of using awareness. And so it's a conscious or more deliberate way of using awareness. Awareness can be used without much consciousness. You can be not so conscious that you're aware. You could be lost in fantasy, and you kind of know what's around you. You're walking down the street, you're lost in the fantasy. Something is registering the fact that you have to stop for oncoming traffic, but you're not really registering in some clear, conscious way. Mindfulness involves a clear, conscious registering of what is happening in the present moment. Clear, conscious taking up, being aware of what's happening now. One definition of mindfulness is the holding of something in the mind. So the word mindfulness in Pali is sati, And the word sati doesn't has broader or different meanings than the English word mindfulness. Remember, when you translate from one language to another, just like, you know, you can't find a word for religion in Japanese or Sanskrit, you can't find a good word for sati in English. We've just chosen mindfulness. But the definition of mindfulness, it's very closely connected to the word to remember. So to hold, to recall something, to recollect something, is to be mindful. And you can recollect a lot of things. You can, if you're given a shopping list, or you're told, you know, yesterday I went with a bunch of 9-year-old boys to see the San Francisco Giants baseball game. It's an all-time American kind of thing to do. This small, really small kind of stadium. This is like a triple A, like the lowest league of the Giants. And it's kind of a fun place to go, all-American kind of thing. And one of the all-American things to do is to get ketchup. I mean, not ketchup, to get hot dogs. They get hot dogs. So one of the dads went to get hot dogs for all these kids. And when he was down there in the you know, wherever you get the stands, the concession, he called to one of the moms to say, well, you know, how many ketchups and ketchup mustard, how many mustard and all that. So there was a long discussion about, you know, over the phone about this number, you know, there was supposed to be actually 5 hot dogs. There was one with ketchup and mustard, one with just mustard, and 3 with just ketchup. And that went through, I was sitting next to the mom, and she was going over and over. He didn't have paper and pencil, I guess, to really get this to register in this dad's mind. this difficult concept of how much ketchup and mustard you have in these hot dogs. And so, you know, it seemed like he got it finally. And the hot dogs came back. And there were 4 hot dogs with mustard. And 1 hot dog with ketchup. And so, I don't know all that happened down there in the concession. But one way of interpreting this is that the dad wasn't able to hold in his mind, wasn't able to recollect the proper order of, you know, how it was supposed to be. So this ability to hold something in mind has to do with mindfulness. So maybe there wasn't much mindfulness there. It hadn't really registered, and he wasn't able to hold it or keep it in the mind. So this idea of bringing something to mind, holding something in mind, keeping it there, is one of the meanings of mindfulness. So you can hold to mind something you have to remember, memorize. You can also bring to mind and hold it to mind your what you're doing. So, you know, you can kind of lose track of what you're doing, get distracted or something, and, oh yeah, I have to do something, I have to do this. I'm listening to someone, and someone's talking, and then, oh yeah, I have to pay attention here. I've had that happen, so maybe none of you, but, you know, I've kind of lost track that someone's talking to me, I'm supposed to be listening. And so you kind of hold something in mind. Now, when you're trying to do something like be mindful of the present moment, hold the present moment in mind, bring it to mind, it can prove very slippery. So you can hold the present moment in mind for a few seconds, and the mind will slip away, float away into some thought about the future, the past, or fantasy, or some kind of concern. And so whereas it might be very easy to hold in mind something that's really, you know, vitally important or vitally interesting and fascinating, there's something about the present moment, maybe it's not so, doesn't seem so vitally important or vitally interesting to keep us engaged with the mindfulness. So our interest takes us away, pulls, we get interested in other things. So a very important part of mindfulness training is to train the mind to be able to bring to mind the present moment and to hold the present moment in mind, to remember the present moment, to recollect the present moment, to collect ourselves at the present moment. It's been said, the cliché said, mindfulness is very easy to do. It's hard, just hard to remember to do it. I would say that mindfulness is easy, it's hard to remember to do it. So just to be aware of what's happening in the moment is easy, but to sustain that over time is hard. So one of the things we want to do in mindfulness is to sustain the attention in the present moment. Now, when you come to the edge of the jungle, before you go in to find this palace, perhaps a very wise thing to do is to, before you enter in, is just to take in the situation. What is a situation? And so there's something about taking in a situation before you judge it, before you analyze it, before you engage in it and manipulate it, do something with it. And so in many circumstances in life, we come to a new situation and the first task is take it in. I'm not going to, so you come into, you come to the edge of the jungle, let's just take it in. Let's get a sense of what the jungle is like so I know what tools I need to bring with me. So I know maybe I'm going to take in, maybe kind of get a sense of what animals are there. You know, so, oh, it'd be useful to take it all in and notice that there are fresh tiger, you know, prints right in front of you, you know, nearby. And, oh, that's interesting. So then you take that in and then you kind of adjust accordingly. So you kind of take in, also you might take in your own, personal capacities. You kind of take in, oh, I'm really tired today. I'm exhausted. I haven't eaten. I don't think this is the time to go into the jungle. I think I need to get ready and prepare myself. Or so you kind of take in, you know, where you're at as well. So there's a kind of sense of taking in what the situation is. So a very important part of mindfulness is just taking things in prior to doing anything with it. So you hold the present moment and you take it in. And this is a very significant movement for many people, because for many people, what the mind is usually doing is not neutrally taking things in, but is manipulating the situation or judging, or is somehow entangled with the life that we're living, with what's going on. So much so that the Buddha said that most of the ways in which we can experience ourselves, experience our body, our breathing, our feelings, our minds, is not some neutral, innocent, natural state. But rather what we're experiencing is we're experiencing the results of how we've shaped ourselves, how we've conditioned ourselves. So Abraham Lincoln, to quote him, said this provocative statement that by the time a person is 40, he or she is responsible for his or her face. There's a way in which the way we use our muscles, the gestures of our face, the way our language, the way we speak, that affects the kind of muscles and the wrinkles and different things. And so there's some ways in which we're responsible for our face to some degree. I mean, mostly you're not, maybe. But there is some way in which how we are conditions. If you spend a lifetime worrying, you get these deep furrows in your forehead. And those furrows, experience of those furrows and that tension has to do with the worry that you've held in place. If you spend a lifetime of being annoyed and angry or aversive, that affects the musculature of your body in a different kind of way. And by the time you're a certain age, it's hard to relax those automatically. So when you feel your body, you feel the results of that tension that might be carried in here. So it's easy to see it physically, that the physical experience of the body somehow is conditioned by, is shaped by what we do. But also our minds are shaped. The patterns of our mind, the habits of the mind, how the mind tends to react to the world around it, the tension and pressure in the mind, is all there. It's been shaped by a lifetime of conditioning, by what we do. And so that conditioning often has a momentum to it. And so a new situation arises and some people automatically, very quickly, will judge it, maybe are aversive to it, or maybe are desirous, or want the good part, or see it, or automatically we see situations in relationship to myself, what it does to me. And so there's all these automatic reactions, responses that goes on. To simply take in the situation without trying to do something pulls the rug from underneath a very common habitual way in which the human mind operates. And for some people, it's very, very radical to simply stop, be aware of the present moment, and do nothing but be aware. It can kind of unravel. For some people, it's even frightening. Can you imagine that? Simply to stop, be aware, and don't do anything else? Why would that be frightening? It's frightening for some people because they depend on a certain way of doing all the time in order to feel safe. And if they stop their doing, it's a little bit disorienting. So, but in fact, most people cannot just simply stop, be aware, and do nothing. What it is, it's often a process of unraveling or undoing. You have the idea of, I'm going to just show up and be mindful and do nothing else. Hold the present moment in awareness. And then slowly you start discovering, this is hard to do. Actually, there's all these little doings. I didn't realize how much I'm always judging. I didn't realize how much I'm always bracing myself and pulling away from my experience. I don't realize how much I'm always evaluating or planning or remembering different, you know. And so slowly, we become more and more familiar with the ways in which there's doing. You can be aware of it physically. And you can slowly, as you sit and meditate, you become aware of the physical holding patterns in your body. And, oh, I thought I wasn't doing anything, but I'm holding my shoulders up. Oh, okay, well, let's do nothing. Let's relax them. Oh, good, now I'm not doing anything. Uh-oh. Actually, now I'm aware I'm holding my belly. I'm still doing something. I'm trying to practice doing nothing, so let's relax the belly. And eventually you feel the body, kind of much of the tension in the body releases, and it's, you know, a wonderful thing. Same thing with the mind. You thought you weren't doing anything. But there can be a lot of things that you're doing in the mind. And so this practice of not doing anything, just holding an awareness, it can be very, very powerful for people. And very liberating to a great degree, because you're undoing all these holding patterns that exist in the mind and the body. And here in the modern America, I don't know if it's more or less than anywhere else in the world, but many Dharma teachers, Buddhist teachers, will teach mindfulness to simply bring to the present moment in mind in some clear way, just be present for what's happening here and now, and then do nothing else. Just be aware, do nothing else. Don't judge your situation, don't be reactive to it. Just hold it in awareness. And they teach that a lot, I think, because for the Western audience that they know, this can be a very radical and powerful thing to do, given the fact there's so much activity that's built up our experience of self. Are you following? And so holding something in the present moment is the meaning of mindfulness. Or taking it in, the situation, coming to the edge of the jungle and taking in the situation. As you take in the situation, part of the function of mindfulness is to be the gatekeeper. Now, there's a changing the analogy quite a bit. In the ancient world, they had these walled cities. There'd be a gate, and there'd be a keeper of the gate. And the keeper of the gate would notice everybody came in and out through the gate. And because the gatekeeper could see who was coming, the gatekeeper could also be involved in deciding whether that person should come in or out, be allowed in or allowed to go out. Mindfulness has a function of placing you at the gate so you can decide whether you want to bring act on something or not act on something. So, for example, if you have eaten 5 hot dogs already with mustard, And you think, wow, this is, you know, I'd love to have one more. It just tastes so good. And your stomach is already distended. And then the gatekeeper function of mindfulness, you would notice, oh, the desire for hot dog arises. And you can say, oh, no, not now. This, you know, the city is full. And so you don't take it in. Or you notice that that you get annoyed at somebody and you want to swear at them. And so you know the gatekeeper notices that momentum to that the words that want to come out of the city, And the gatekeeper said, no, this is not useful. No, not now. So part of the function of mindfulness is to hold something in mind, but it also has a function of evaluating what it is that we're seeing. There's an evaluative process in mindfulness. It sees what's helpful, it sees what's not helpful. Very simple. It's a little bit more than just the bare awareness of something. There's also an evaluative process that goes on. And it's a natural process, and pretty natural, in the sense that I think if you're really aware, taking in what's going on in a full, cognizant way, it often becomes kind of clear, oh, this is useful and this is not. So that's another aspect of mindfulness. So mindfulness is mindfulness. Right mindfulness is something more, something different than just mindfulness. Right mindfulness, as part of the path, is defined as the four applications of mindfulness, or the four foundations of mindfulness, or the four practices of mindfulness. Now, if you have, if you say, I run a lot, I run, that can elicit a lot of different images in your mind of what I mean. It could mean I'm running after the bus. You know, it could mean I'm running away from the tiger. It could mean that I'm running with my kids for joy running. You know, it just doesn't say much, just that I'm running. But if you say, you know, I do a running practice, that kind of immediately has a different connotation. Running practice maybe implies a sense of discipline, it implies a certain training regime perhaps, and maybe it implies a certain kind of associations. We have the idea of doing it as a practice, as a training. I'm training to run. So mindfulness practice has a broader meaning than what mindfulness is. And So mindfulness then is a classically it's said that mindfulness, when you practice mindfulness, holding the present moment in mind, it is a magnet for other qualities that join it. Or you can bring other qualities of mind to join and partner up with mindfulness. And when you bring other qualities of mind, activities of the mind, to partner with mindfulness, then you have mindfulness practice. And mindfulness, and there are many different kinds of running practice, ways of training to run. There are many different kinds of mindfulness practices. So, for example, there is a practice of mindfulness of death. This is a practice where you recollect, you bring to mind the subject of death and dying as a spiritual practice. It's a very honored practice in Buddhism. It's a very particular kind of mindfulness practice. It's a practice of bringing to mind the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha. Bringing it to mind, holding it in mind, reflecting on it, being inspired by it. There's a practice of bringing to mind, being mindful of the Buddha, the qualities of the Buddha, of an enlightened person. There's a practice of, there's also the practice of recollecting loving kindness, being mindful of loving kindness, being mindful of compassion. So you can choose what you're being mindful of. You can also choose how you're mindful. You can be mindful casually, or you can be mindful energetically. You can take something in fully, or you can take something in kind of half-heartedly. Mindfulness practice involves taking things in fully. Really kind of being really present for something. The ancient texts talk about being present for something face to face. You're really there face to face to see something. I've been present for people, I've talked to people who don't really, for some reason, they aren't comfortable with kind of being face to face. And I've been, I like kind of being more or less kind of looking at people, being present for people when I'm there. And I've known people who, as soon as I was face to face kind of with them, they would turn 90 degrees and kind of, they don't really want to be present. They don't really, in that kind of full way. Maybe I'm intimidating. And so they kind of turn, and they're looking this way. And then a couple of times in my life, I've actually done the experiment of then followed them around. and they turn sideways, and I turn around to face them again, and I've gone 360 degrees around them. And I don't think they knew what was going on. It's so kind of automatic or unconscious what they're doing. So to really meet someone face to face, to really let something register deeply and well, is a very important part of mindfulness practice. Whereas just being open and aware might not entail a deep registering of the experience. Being open and aware and not doing anything is a very useful practice where people have done too much. But mindfulness practice entails deliberately and consciously allowing yourself to take in and registering deeply what is it that's really here. So another ancient analogy. If you put a pumpkin on top of a river, the pumpkin will float away on top of the surface. If you take a rock and put it on the river, the rock sinks right to the bottom of the river. If there's no strong mindfulness, then the mind all too easily will float away in the river of thoughts. If there is strong mindfulness, it's like having a rock, it just goes, sinks right into the river, right into the lake. It's right there for it, kind of grounded and settled in the experience. In this analogy, you're not supposed to be like a pumpkin that just floats away. You're supposed to be like a rock, solid and strong, just kind of sits, kind of goes straight down, goes right into the experience. It doesn't kind of skim the surface of something, but really connects deeply. This mindfulness practice involves having a penetrating presence for what our experience is, as opposed to a superficial presence. So even the experience of being mindful of your breathing, I know from my own experience, it's very easy to have a superficial contact with my breathing. I can stay kind of present in my breath, and I kind of know that I'm breathing, I'm there. But it's not really deeply registering the experience of breathing. It's not really a clear face-to-face meeting. It's not really being there fully for that experience of breathing. And so mindfulness practice involves a deep kind of penetrating or registering of the experience. Here it is. Does that sound exhausting? It can. But even more so when you hear that mindfulness practice, as it's classically defined as one of the foundations of mindfulness, also entails having ardency, certain ardor. Now it's exhausting, right? There's some kind of enthusiasm or zeal or energy that we apply ourselves. I'm going to do this. As opposed to, I'll just kind of float here in the present moment in such a wonderful place and just kind of, just going to be relaxed. There's a kind of sense of purpose and sense of engagement that is a little more energetic than just kind of very casual. However, some of you might have the experience of having a hobby or reading a book or doing something that you really applied yourself to, and as you applied yourself to it, by the time you finished doing it, you also felt more relaxed. Being energetically engaged does not preclude the possibility of being really relaxed and calm in the activity itself. So this is very important to realize, because part of what we're trying to do in mindfulness practice is to find an energetic engagement in the practice that also allows us to get very calm at the same time. And then mindfulness, so the Buddha defined right mindfulness as the four foundations of mindfulness. The four foundations of mindfulness entail three primary things: being mindful, holding something in mind, being ardent in that engagement, and the last thing is clearly knowing what it is you're being mindful of. So you can clearly register, clearly be present for something. That's a little bit different than really registering and seeing, as I'm really present for this in-breath, what I experience, I'm feeling an expansion and movement. That movement is smooth, and right near the end it stops being smooth and becomes a little bit jagged, and then a feeling of tautness at the end of the in-breath. There's maybe at the beginning of the in-breath there's a little pulling in at the belly that happens, And then there's this expanding feeling. There's a sense of temperature, smoothness. There's all these different sensations that make up the experience of breathing in. So mindfulness is not just holding the breath in mind, but it's also knowing what the experience is really like. A real knowing. There's a cognitive function of mindfulness practice, but there's also a knowing of what's going on. So why is this kind of mindfulness part of the path? Because if you want to walk the path into the jungle, you want to be able to register and take in what's really going on in yourself and around you, so you can walk the appropriate way, you can find the way. You want to be able to have the ability to be present enough to be discerning, to really see what are the elements of the path that you need to cultivate. So it's hard to maybe sometimes see what you need to cultivate unless you really take yourself in well and deeply. It's hard to know that maybe you need to work on your ethics or your speech. It's hard to know that you need to kind of change your behavior sometimes in some ways in order to be really engaged in the path in an appropriate way. You might see it in gross ways. If you're robbing banks, you realize that doesn't really work for someone on the path. But you might be very, very subtle ways in which you exaggerate when you talk. And it's hard to see maybe that subtle exaggerations hinders the path. It's one of the part of the overgrowth or the trail. So you need to kind of really be able to stop and take in and see what's going on, to see the effect of your behavior, of your thoughts, of your speech, and to see what's happening in the situation. You might find out that you're a little bit confused about what the path is. The more you stop and pay attention, you see that, I'm not sure what this path is. I have this vague idea it's a good thing to do to be on a path, but what is this path? And so then you say, okay, well, let's find out, let's go back to the beginning of the beginning of the description of the path and understand right view and clarify that, what right view really is. It really provides the map of the path. And then finally, as we do this mindfulness practice, taking in and registering, being present for ourselves in a deep way, one of the four foundations of mindfulness that we're told to pay attention to is the inner processes, the inner causal events that lead us to either have more suffering or lead us to more freedom. We're taught to pay attention to those inner movements where we're clinging, grasping, and thereby suffering. Or those inner movements where there's a release of suffering, release of clinging, release of grasping. And part of the function of mindfulness is clear, deep mindfulness, is so we can start seeing what it is that we're doing, where the places of clinging might be, where the choices in the mind might be, so that we can find ourselves in that place where we can release the mind completely. And mindfulness is a really important capacity to do that. So in order to do that, you have to be able to hold your mind in your awareness, hold what's going on within you in a spacious, clear way. You have to be able to do it in a way that you're really taking it in deeply, a real deep face-to-face meeting in the experience. So you really know and see, what is this experience? And then as you see that deeply, then the release can happen. The freedom can happen. The argument or the idea in Buddhism is that it's hard to see how deeply the mind is held in the grip of clinging unless that mindfulness is really strong and really, really calm, really still. Sometimes we can have the illusion that the mind is free. Sometimes mindfulness or awareness has these beautiful qualities to it. Sometimes awareness can feel very spacious. Sometimes you can feel very empty in the field of awareness or mindfulness. Sometimes you can feel very happy. But it might be temporary. The tendencies to suffer or to cling are latent and ready to operate at a moment's notice. Or it might be that they're operating, but they're subtle enough that somehow, and our mindfulness is not sensitive enough, that we don't actually see that it's operating. And there's plenty of people who, for example, spiritual kind of people, who come to the conclusion that they're enlightened when they're not. And so it takes a path of careful work not to be fooled by oneself. And the beautiful thing is that we each have our own capacity. We all have the capacity to unfool ourselves. If we engage, if we trust the path of keep doing the mindfulness practice and looking more and more deeply. And the great ally for this ability to look deeply and let your mindfulness correct for the problems that might exist is concentration. And concentration is the last element of the Eightfold Path. It's called right concentration. And that will have to be for another day or another month. Do this about once a month, these things. So I hope that made sense to you. I know it's a lot of information, a lot of stuff, but I wanted to kind of convey it to you because it's easy to have a simple idea of what mindfulness is, and I want to kind of open it up. And hopefully some of this will percolate in and some of it will inspire you to meet your life, your experience of life, face to face, fully. Thank you.